remembered answering the phone. And I said, have you found her? And he said, I hope you're sitting down.
The homicide squad has been called in to investigate the death of a woman in Melbourne. The 24-year-old's body was discovered last night on the ground floor of a St Kilda Road apartment building.
As soon as I found out how she died, ostensibly by climbing into a garbage chute when she was pissed.
I don't think she climbed in there by herself.
I have no idea how anybody thinks anybody could get in that thing.
She hated being caged and she was claustrophobic. So I can't see her ending her life that way.
She was my baby. And I wanted to find out. And so I've done it. I've lived it, the whole thing, from the start. And it's sort of still not over.
This is episode 6 of Phoebe's Fall, a podcast from the Age newsroom in Melbourne. I'm Michael Batchelard.
And I'm Richard Baker.
And we've been investigating the short life and brutal death of Phoebe Handsjuck.
My initial reaction was he did not want to have an inquest. And the finding came out as if there hadn't been one.
That's Len Handsjuck, Phoebe's father, talking about how he felt that the coroner, Peter White, didn't want to hold an inquest into his daughter's death.
Last episode, we explored how each family held its own farewell for Phoebe and the high emotions that emerged. This time, in our final episode, we're looking at the notion of justice and asking the question, did the coronial inquest into Phoebe's death deliver it?
From the beginning, Phoebe's boyfriend, Ant Hampel, was adamant that he didn't want to hear about how she'd died. And as time passed, he took the view that an inquest wasn't needed.
If the coroner wants to see you, of course that's fine, but I don't ever want to hear it from anybody ever. I want to remember it.
That was Ant from the secret tape that Phoebe's mother, Natalie, made a few days after her daughter's death. Ant said he just wanted to remember Phoebe sleeping in peace.
We thought that that he ought to be wanting to do everything he possibly could to find out what happened. But the only explanation that I had was that he was absolutely convinced from the moment that he found out that she was dead that she had killed herself.
That's Phoebe's mother, Natalie. Rich, it seems to me that every time there's a suspicious death of a woman, police always look first at the partner. Was Ant ever considered a suspect?
Not really. Police seemed to instantly accept his word that Phoebe wasn't home when he got there, and he and his supporters were allowed back into the apartment when it was a potential crime scene, with blood in different rooms and broken glass on the floor.
He was interviewed by police, but we heard last time he typed out his own statement.
That's right, and remember, the phone and the computer weren't seized until much later.
This approach was pretty different from another high-profile Melbourne case, the murder of Jill Maher, and the treatment of her husband, Tom, by police while she was still a missing person.
What you're about to hear comes from a recent ABC documentary on the Jill Maher case.
The initial investigation that focused on Tom Maher, it was necessary to do, but when you think about it down the track...
I just wanted to say very briefly that I've been really humbled by the support of the Australian public, the tireless efforts of the police.
You're left thinking, geez, we're pretty awful for the way we've treated this poor guy. Not only has he lost his wife, but now he's being treated pretty badly by us.
That was Detective Senior Sergeant David Butler from the Victorian Homicide Squad, who led the investigation. He was followed there by Jill Maher's husband, Tom Maher. He spent 3 days being treated as the prime suspect before other evidence led police to the belief that she'd been abducted and murdered by a stranger.
In Phoebe's case, though, police on the scene that first night were already concluding that this was a suicide, particularly after they were told about Phoebe's episodes of depression.
Perhaps that explains why they believed there was no need for anyone to be treated as a suspect.
The role of the coroner's court is to investigate what happened around a death, to work out who died, the circumstances in which they died, and the causes of death.
How important is it to them, I guess, even emotionally, for the court to be... for findings, I suppose, to be solid?
it's enormously important for families and for everyone else associated with the death, who might have had some role in bringing it about or be affected by it, that the outcomes are right and that they command the confidence of everyone involved as having been the product of sound and rigorous investigation. It matters a great deal.
That's Melbourne barrister Ian Freckleton QC. He's one of Australia's foremost experts on coronial law and a member of the Victorian Government Council that oversees the workings of the Coroner's Court.
Ant had already made it clear he didn't want to know details about Phoebe's death. And when the time came for the coroner to decide whether he'd hold an inquest, Ant's lawyers stood up in court to oppose it.
If Ant had agreed to talk to us for this podcast, the first thing I would have asked is, why didn't you want an inquest? See Michelle McDonald, who's a lawyer for the Federation of Community Legal Centres in Victoria. She's an expert in all matters of coronial law.
The majority of cases that end up in the coroner's court are actually decided without an inquest process. So a coroner will review documents, statements, and make a decision, a finding, and potentially recommendations without going through that inquest process.
Michelle McDonald was the principal researcher for the Victorian Parliament's two-year inquiry into the Coroner's Act, and she's worked in coronial law for a decade.
Phoebe's mum, Natalie, worried about getting a proper inquest, one where evidence is given in open court and witnesses are cross-examined. She feared the homicide squad's suicide assumption and Ant's opposition to an inquest would result in Phoebe getting a cursory, tick-the-box-style inquiry.
That was a fear reinforced after a preliminary hearing before Coroner Peter White in 2012.
And in that directions hearing, the coroner wouldn't say whether he was going to hold an inquest, and he also said that if he did, he was quite inclined to have it behind closed doors, like not have an opening.
This concern drove Natalie and Lorne to contact me and our colleague at The Age, Nick McKenzie, in 2012. They also reached out to the Seven Network's Sunday Night program. Up until then, the name Phoebe Handschuck had never made the news.
Tonight,
what do you think has really happened to Phoebe?
A beautiful girl with a glamorous lifestyle, but her death was bizarre. We begin with the mysterious death of beautiful Phoebe Handschuck.
What pushed it over the line was probably the Channel 7's Sunday Night program, plus the stuff that you blokes wrote too. People were sort of thinking there's a bit of a stench about this.
I was left feeling completely convinced that if it wasn't for the public, the media exposure, we wouldn't have had our inquest.
To have to fight for an inquest in a case like this, which just, it just shouted out there's something not right here.
Coroner White eventually ruled against Ant Hample's application to prevent an inquest and decided that a full hearing would be held in open court in 2013. This meant the public would hear evidence in an effort to find out whether Phoebe's death was suicide, foul play, or an accident.
As well as feeling they had to fight to even get an inquest, Phoebe's family was finding it hard to get legal representation. Almost all the top barristers in Melbourne were either friends with or had worked with Ant's father, retired Judge George Hample, and his stepmother, sitting Judge Felicity Hample. George Hample held an Order of Australia, and he was a formidable legal figure.
My name is Professor George Hample. I'm a professor of law at Monash University. Part of my teaching involves training of experts. We also explore matters such as bias by experts, which is a concern for courts. We look at how people can...
Professor Hample was so well known, it almost derailed Phoebe's family's ability to find legal representation.
Natalie remembers travelling the 6 hours from Mallacoota for a meeting with one of Melbourne's best-known criminal lawyers.
But when she arrived, he wasn't there. It was left to his assistant to break the news that he couldn't represent her at the inquest. He felt conflicted due to his previous association with the Hamples.
And his assistant added that actually, he said, I think you're going to struggle to find anyone in this state to represent you that doesn't have a conflict of interest.
In the end, Natalie did find a lawyer.
While all the legal manoeuvring was going on, South Melbourne detective Brendan Payne was getting on with the job of taking statements and gathering evidence for the inquest as the officer preparing the brief for the coroner. It needs to be said that while Phoebe's family were disappointed by the efforts of the homicide squad, they have nothing but praise for Payne's work.
Multiple bruises to the inside of her right upper arm, the scattered bruises over the front and lateral aspect of her left shoulder, the bruise at the back of the neck, the bruise in the left temporalis muscle, which is the muscle above the ear on the left side, and the subdural hemorrhage.
Now, that's Byron Collins, a forensic pathologist with 40 years' experience, commenting on the injuries to Phoebe's body that may have been sustained before she entered the chute. He reviewed forensic and medical reports for us.
There are a number of injuries which concern me, which may well have been present prior to Phoebe entering the chute, and one can't say with any degree of certainty.
So, Rich, it was the keen eye of Detective Payne that first noticed some of these bruises on Phoebe. How did that come about?
Well, Payne was looking at the photos of Phoebe's body, and he noticed these suspicious-looking bruises to her upper body, including under her right arm. He realised they hadn't been commented on by the pathologist who did Phoebe's autopsy, Matthew Lynch, so he asked Lynch to take another look.
And we know that in his supplementary report, Lynch said the bruises were, I quote, consistent with, but not specific for, grip marks.
Yeah, and a third pathologist, Queensland's Peter Ellis, also noticed the underarm bruising. We got an actor to read part of his report to Phoebe's family, which was also presented at the inquest.
Shapes of bruises are not necessarily specific, but in this case, they do support the application of fingertips to the inside of the arm, most often seen in the forceful holding of the arm.
While the bruises under Phoebe's arm are by no means conclusive, they do raise the possibility of her being carried against her will to the chute. To me, it's remarkable that the pathologist overlooked it the first time around.
Especially when you combine them with the bruising to the side of her temple. Even though he hadn't commented on the bruising to Phoebe's body, the pathologist, Matthew Lynch, explicitly told the coroner he couldn't rule out foul play in Phoebe's death. Picking out those bruises was an important discovery by Detective Payne. He's still in the police force and declined to talk to us for this podcast.
But we know from his evidence at the inquest that he felt that a few things weren't stacking up. And he was clearly annoyed by what happened when he asked Ant to make a second statement. Here's an actor reading Detective Payne's account.
On the 24th of January 2011, Anthony Hample attended the offices of the South Melbourne CIU at my request to make a secondary statement. Hample was in the company of his father, George Hample, who was adamant he wished to remain with his son during the taking of the statement. Despite my endeavours to insist on Anthony's statement to be taken privately, Hample Sr. remained present due to, quote, his son's state of mind as he was grieving.
The community of Mallacoota ran a fundraising night and had an auction night. We raised $16,000 in one night. And then Phoebe's close friends, including Vanessa Levin, organised another fundraiser in Melbourne and they raised over $7,000.
That's Natalie describing a series of events to help pay for the legal bills they would run up during the three-week inquest into Phoebe's death.
There seemed to be a lot of people who wanted to know what had happened and were supporting us in our quest, I guess.
The inquest was held at the Melbourne Coroner's Court in August 2013. With 26 witnesses, it was a big one. And Natalie was there every day.
Natalie, Ant and Victoria Police were all represented by barristers. But the key lawyer at the inquest was Deborah Semensma, who was the counsel assisting the coroner.
On Thursday, the 2nd of December 2010, the body of Phoebe Handstruck was found in a ground floor refuse room at the Balencia apartment complex in St Kilda Road, Melbourne. Phoebe was 24 years old. She lived on the
From the outset, floor of the it was clear that Coroner White had a complex, high-profile case before him with evidence going in all directions.
One of the factors making it hard to issue any finding at all was the appalling police investigation, as we detailed in Episode 4.
During the inquest, Coroner White directed experienced homicide detective Sol Solomon to review the police work in Phoebe's case and provide his own opinion. Solomon wasn't critical of his colleagues. Instead, he urged the coroner to focus on Stilnox, also known as Zolpidem or Ambien.
To get a good night's sleep, try two-layer Ambien CR. When taking Ambien CR, don't drive or operate machinery. Sleepwalking and eating or driving while not fully awake, with memory loss for the event, as well as abnormal behaviors such as being more outgoing or aggressive than normal, confusion, agitation, and hallucinations may occur. Don't take it with alcohol, as it may increase these. Wake up ready for your day. Ask your healthcare provider for two-layer Ambien CR.
As a sleeping drug, Stilnox works, but in the past few years, it's got itself a bad name.
The trouble surrounding Olympic champion Grant Hackett has taken another turn, with reports he previously battled an addiction to the sleeping pill Stilnox.
Tonight here to a member of the famous Kennedy family back in court after a dangerous moment on the highway, blaming it on an Ambien mix-up.
Kennedy, a daughter of Robert F. Kennedy, swerved her Lexus into a tractor trailer on a New York highway and was later found slumped over the wheel of her car.
When Phoebe died, she had what was described as a therapeutic dose of Stilnox in her blood, 0.2 milligrams, as well as 0.16 blood alcohol concentration, three times the legal driving limit. So, was the Stilnox and alcohol combination to blame for Phoebe's death, the trigger for a tragic accident, as the coroner concluded?
It's a good question, and I reckon there are two issues here. Firstly, was it likely that she could behave oddly or unpredictably while she was on it? And secondly, could it allow her to perform an act of significant balance and strength, like climbing feet first into the garbage chute?
Various doctors gave evidence at the inquest, but no sleep experts were asked to testify, so we consulted a few ourselves.
Probably the most unusual will be driving your car in your sleep, and so we have had about 60 or 70 reports of that through our helpline alone.
But that's Geraldine Moses. She's a clinical pharmacologist who has a special interest in Stilnox, and who runs a helpline that gathers information about adverse reactions to the drug.
People can do all kinds of behaviours, but a lot of them tend to walk out of the house, get straight in the car and drive off somewhere. Other people have cooked and eaten. Cleaning has happened a lot. One of the other things we have had reported, we probably have about 20-odd cases of them on our archive, is people walking off balconies. So
if you're going to die from Stilnox, it's most likely to be from an overdose. But it has been associated with some bizarre deaths.
There's a term, defenestration. It means jumping out a window. So people move from wherever they were sleeping, climb stairs or whatever, open a window and jump out. It's not something they would normally do and would require some manual dexterity.
So that certainly answers the first question. Can people do bizarre things while on Stilnox?
Right. But could Phoebe have performed the difficult physical feat of climbing into the garbage chute while under the influence of Stilnox and alcohol?
Well, even the doctors at the inquest were sceptical about that. They said alcohol and Stilnox would each make it more difficult for her to act in that way, and even more so when they were combined.
Ron Grunstein, who's the head of the Centre for Respiratory Failure and Sleep Disorders at the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital in Sydney, also has his doubts.
It's possible for people to do dangerous things on any form of sleeping medication. I just, would say that it is a rare effect. And also, when you start talking about complex behaviours, it starts to get a little bit, hard to believe.
Professor Grunstein has looked at the evidence in Phoebe's case and considered the mix of alcohol and Stilnox in her blood.
But in any case, the sum of that would make someone less able to do complex tasks. And from what I've seen related to photographs of this garbage chute and, the size of Phoebe, just from looking at the sort of behaviour that would be required to get into that, I would be very sceptical that that was how the events occurred. I've got a half a dozen colleagues around Australia and also in the United States who do a fair amount of medico-legal work around bizarre behaviours during sleep. They shared my scepticism.
And even Geraldine Moses, who runs the hotline where people report bizarre behaviour under the influence of Stilnox, can't quite get her head around Phoebe's story.
Another thing is often people take this on long-haul flights. So I've had many stories of people getting up and roaming the aeroplane, doing wheeze and poos in the aisle, trying to get into the cockpit, attacking the crew. One lady saying to the crew, right, meet me outside the plane now. Anything's possible with Zolpidem, really. It's just that, as you say, the ability to get into the chute sounds a bit too much, doesn't it?
While the inquest went for over 3 weeks, Ant Hample only came one day to give evidence and once as a spectator. That was the day his old friend, Vanessa Levin, told the coroner that she felt Ant had been putting his emotions on and off.
Remember, Ant had opposed the inquest being held and later testified that he'd never given much thought to it in the days and months after Phoebe died.
Well, that's what he said when he was asked why he hadn't kept the SIM card from Phoebe's iPhone.
There wasn't a reason in your mind you might hold on to the SIM card in case there was an inquest?
I didn't have a reason to.
But if Detective Payne has told you on the 2nd of November that he thought there was likely to be an inquest, was that not a reason to hold on to the SIM card?
No, I think that was an opinion of his, and it was certainly not something I gave a lot of thought to.
Less than a fortnight before Christmas 2014, Natalie made the long drive to Melbourne to hear the final outcome. Her mind was running through the various possibilities.
I didn't think he'd be able to rule it as a suicide. I didn't think he would say that it was a homicide or a murder. I knew that. So it left us with only two options, and one, the one that we were holding on to, was that he would make an open finding. So that if, you know, other evidence came to light in the future, that the case could be reopened.
The other possibility crossing Natalie's mind was a finding of accidental death.
It took 16 months for Coroner Peter White to deliver his finding. By the time he did, it was 4 years after Phoebe's death.
I find that Phoebe climbed into the chute in an unconscious state with a level of motor control in place or, at the very least, that she was deeply confused and quite unable to think in a rational manner. Phoebe's long-term enthusiasm for climbing and penchant for undertaking physically challenging activity was a factor in this event.
In other words, this was a tragic accident.
I asked Lorne Campbell, Phoebe's grandfather, what he thought of the finding.
It was ridiculous, frankly. We were just aghast.
Well, I have to say that I felt as though Coroner White had already made up his mind before the inquest even began, and that he was directing his inquiry in a way that would support his own theory.
Rich, you were in the court the day the coroner delivered his finding. What was it like?
Well, I remember looking at the face of Coroner White's counsel assisting, Deborah Semensma. She looked really annoyed. She'd recommended an open finding, saying there wasn't enough evidence to prove either way whether it was suicide, homicide, or accidental death.
Right, but the coroner went against that, and isn't it highly unusual for a coroner to ignore the advice of his counsel assisting?
Yeah, it is. You'd expect he'd take more notice of her recommendation. And I wonder, given her reaction, if he even told Deborah Semensma that he was going to reject her submission.
There was another thing too. She'd advised the coroner that the evidence wasn't strong enough for Ant Hample to be ruled in or ruled out from the possibility of involvement in Phoebe's death.
That is not to say he had any involvement, but rather there is an inability to exculpate on the balance of probabilities. Moreover, there were aspects of Mr. Hample's evidence that were unsatisfactory in that they were clearly a reconstruction. At times he would agree with a proposition until such time as an inconsistency was pointed out, and that other aspects of his evidence were not consistent with objective facts.
Right, but Coroner White dismissed her view on that as well. Instead, he completely cleared Ant Hample.
We should add here that Ant said on oath he had no involvement in Phoebe's death, and we're not suggesting otherwise.
There's one more aspect to this finding. The coroner came to the view that Phoebe's relative lack of internal injuries meant she must have controlled her descent down the chute.
She then levered herself into the chute and commenced to move down the chute cylinder by pressing her extremities and her bottom and back against opposite walls of the chute, withstanding her drug, alcohol intoxication. But the evidence does not suggest that she undertook this conduct either intending to end her own life. If she had got into the chute cylinder involuntarily, having been placed there by an assailant, there would have been major trauma resulting in internal injuries, as well as external injuries to her torso and head and limbs.
Rich, the coroner has made the link in his mind that Phoebe's relative lack of internal injuries means she controlled her fall, which means she must have consciously put herself in the chute, and therefore nobody else was involved.
Yeah, but there was no dirt or injuries on the outside of her arms that would suggest she controlled her descent. And he also disregarded some injuries she did have, like the bruises on the inside of her arms. Forensic pathologist Byron Collins, who reviewed the evidence for us, is sceptical.
Yes, I certainly am. I don't think that one can say with any degree of certainty whether the fall was free or whether it was impeded by some effort in trying to press perhaps her arms against the sides of the chute to slow the fall down. There are a number of possibly unexplained injuries present on Phoebe's body, which need not necessarily have occurred during the fall. And I feel, therefore, that the most appropriate finding would be open. And that's basically...
Even the pathologist who examined Phoebe's body, Matthew Lynch, told Coroner White in open court that he had no view on the proposition that Phoebe had slowed her own descent. Phoebe's grandfather, the retired detective Lorne Campbell, felt the evidence simply didn't support the coroner's interpretation.
It is a big stretch, and the coroner was at pains to try and persuade the pathologist to go his way with that. He really almost led him to the point of saying, well, don't you agree with me on this? Lynch, the pathologist, couldn't make that jump. He really remained non-committal about it in the end. It was such an absurd thing to suggest that she could do that. For a start, she couldn't get through that aperture with her arms by her sides. She just wouldn't fit through. So for her to go through there, her arms had to be trailing behind her. And for her then, once she started falling, to get them into a position where she could apply the brakes, it's just physically impossible. Physically impossible to put out enough lateral pressure with your hands above your head. You couldn't do that. And apart from anything else, the inside of that thing was bloody filthy. It was filthy, and she would have had dirt all over her, which she didn't have.
Retired homicide detective Roland Legg was also unable to rule out foul play, nor could he find enough evidence for a firm conclusion of accidental death.
On what I have at the moment, I wouldn't be able to make a decision one way or the other. Probably wouldn't be able to establish a gut feeling. It's a bizarre set of circumstances, and there are a lot of unanswered questions on what I've been provided anyway.
Sleep expert Professor Ron Grunstein agrees.
All I'm just saying is that if you look at the hard evidence, it's hard to be that, you know, convinced as it appears the coroner was in this case.
So an open finding really was the only finding available from your point of view?
From my non-legal point of view, that would be a reasonable thing to do, make it an open finding.
And I guess because the circumstances were so sort of mysterious and still remain largely unexplained, the accidental death thing, it just seemed absurd to me, really. And the most absurd part of it was for his suggestion that she controlled her fall by shimmying down the inside of the chute when she was so drunk and, you know, incapacitated by prescription medications. That was the most absurd thing.
We wanted to ask the coroner to explain why he found as he did. Why did he say Phoebe slowed her fall? What was wrong with his counsel assisting's call for an open finding? On what evidence did he identify Stillnox as the culprit? but he declined our request.
It seems to me the coroner has tried to find evidence for the easiest explanation. If you blame Stilnox and alcohol, then no actual person is responsible for Phoebe's death. Not her for taking her own life. And you certainly don't have to bother finding out if a third party was involved. Meanwhile, 2 years after the coroner delivered his findings, there are still court-enforced suppression orders over much of the material, including the statements to the inquest, parts of the video of Phoebe's last day, and parts of the secret recording that Natalie Handsjuk made of Ant Hampel and his family. These suppression orders have no end date. They are indefinite. It would be a criminal offence for us to publish those things.
And so, 4 years after Phoebe died, a coronial process Phoebe's family hoped would provide some answers ended with bitter disappointment and bewilderment.
I think that, you know, to make such a clear-cut kind of conclusion to something that was by no means clear is quite astonishing. I think there's this facade that's maintained that, oh, you know, everything, you know, you'll always, you know, get, you know, there's all, you're always protected and, you know, the state's there to do all this, all these systems are in place, but really that's all rubbish.
It feels like a really botched case with so, so many elements missing, pieces of evidence that could have explained something, and stupid, condescending or something, you know, of the judge to have called those findings. Like, we're not stupid. The family's not stupid.
That's Phoebe's old friend Hazel Brown and her brother Tom reflecting on what they regard as the lingering injustice in Phoebe's case.
Phoebe's family genuinely believe she was intending to go out the afternoon she died. The evidence seemed clear. Her sunglasses were found near her body, and her phone charger was in her handbag, which was left on the kitchen counter. Her hair straightener was also plugged in and turned on.
The family wanted to appeal Coroner White's finding. A top law firm and high-profile QC, Ross Gillies, offered to assess their prospects pro bono. Gillies described Coroner White's finding as highly unlikely. But even though they were willing to act for free, both Gillies and K&L Gates partner Peter McGrath told the family that with the law as it is, an appeal would be highly risky. This is an actor reading Peter McGrath's advice.
If you are unsuccessful in the appeal and costs are awarded against you, the other parties will be able to seek to recover their legal costs and disbursements from you personally. Assuming the hearing runs for 3 days, the best indication we can provide is that the amount will certainly exceed $120,000.
The grounds for appeal are now limited, and put simply, they are that there must have been an error of law in the coroner's findings. The coroner must have applied a wrong test, have misunderstood something fundamentally, or have reached a decision which was absolutely not open on the evidence.
That was Ian Freckledon QC explaining the only way a coroner's finding can be appealed in Victoria. With two sons still studying, the risk of more than $100,000 in legal costs was too much for Natalie.
You know, we've gone as far as we can legally. Walking out of that office that day, I felt like we'd just lost a battle. We'd really, really fought for. Pretty disappointing. And I did walk away feeling like this is not a justice system, not at all. You know, this is a life. A beautiful young girl's lost her life. And it just, and it's been covered over, like, and yeah, like Len said, she's just been treated like a piece of garbage. It's pretty hard.
Community lawyer Michelle McDonnell says the Handsjuk family are not the only ones who confront this reality.
And I've seen examples of people suffering severe grief and psychological distress because they have not been able to accept the finding of a coroner, or they haven't been able to make a successful appeal to have the inquest reopened. And they're left with this terrible sense of tension, of what if, and it really plagues them for the rest of their lives. And
Ian Freckleton couldn't comment directly on Phoebe's inquest due to his position on the Victorian Government's Coronial Council. But we asked him if there's room to change the system to allow families more avenues to appeal.
I think the key issue is to have the Coroner's Court functioning at a high level where its reasons are well enunciated and where there is good representation and expert witnesses are suitably involved so that the calibre of decision-making is of a high order. However, if something falls short in those regards, then the high threshold for a feasible appeal becomes problematic. And inevitably, there will
Phoebe's case has created a real public discussion about these issues, hasn't it, Rich?
It sure has. Since we began this series, the Victorian Opposition has pledged to reform the Coroner's Act to widen the scope for appeals.
And the Victorian Labor Government has said it will look at suggestions to reduce the cost burden on families who wish to challenge contentious coronial findings.
And those developments are welcome. We also approached the police to see if they'd consider apologising to Phoebe's family for the poor quality of their initial investigation, but they refused.
But we hope this series has helped to unlock some of the mysteries surrounding Phoebe's death and to highlight some of the systemic failures in the investigation and the coronial process.
There's so much that's still unanswered here. Phoebe's family strongly believe there are people who know more about her death. They want them to come forward and tell police what they know so the case can be reopened.
Meanwhile, we're also following up on some information that's come in since we began the podcast, so we'll stay on the story.
But whatever may come next, nothing can replace what Phoebe's parents, Natalie and Len, have lost.
Walking through sands, recalling time and its quickening hands, hopes and dreams washed up on the shore. Broken shells reflect what's left of ourselves. Memories of you tattooed in my mind, permanent, untouched. A thousand words left unsaid. If only we could turn back the clock.
I found this that was done at art in her art class, and I thought, I wonder if at some deep unconscious level we all know our destiny, our ultimate destiny. And this was this thing about the fallen angel.
Quite a premonition.
Yes. If it was.
If it was, yeah.
Yeah.
Could you read that for us, Matt?
Yeah, it says here, fallen angel, wings of silver, hair of gold, a heart without belonging breaks and folds, and so she falls. Without sound, no one turns around, just another soul who's forever lost and never found.
She was my baby. And I wanted to find out. And so I've done it. I've lived it, the whole thing, from the start. And it's sort of still not over.
I looked for you in the ballroom. Steal the things you were hiding. I tried to make you let me in.
The fallout of Phoebe's death is still reverberating in the Hample family too. While Ander's married, his sister Christina still thinks about Phoebe. In March this year, Chrissy posted a message on Facebook, together with a photo of her and Phoebe.
Remember, Chrissy Hample is Ant's older sister who pleaded guilty to trafficking cocaine, but was let off with no criminal conviction.
Her post only stayed online for about 12 hours, but somebody sent it to me. This post was the catalyst for the Phoebe's Fall podcast. It made me want to tell the story properly, once and for all. So I rang Chrissy Hample to see if she'd talk about it, what was behind her message, but she hung up. So we'll end Phoebe's Fall with a reading of that post instead.
In loving memory, I just stumbled across my favourite pic of beautiful Phoebe. I miss you, darling. You were a fragile little flower that no one watered. You and your family were let down by the justice system and those who represent it. I only hope one day that the truth will come out so that they may have some peace.
It's the little minutes in the day that make it hard to believe you're real when you're away. It's the heaving hours after dark and my dreams that let me know you are. One night I touched your side, I put my hand on your ribs, and you faded from me. Of course it was a dream, and once again I've been sucked in. It's the little minutes in the day that make it hard to believe you're real. It's the heaving hours after dark and my dreams that let me know you are.
If you found any of the material in this podcast disturbing, you can call Lifeline or Beyond Blue if you're in Australia, or your local crisis service.
Phoebe's Fall is presented by Richard Baker and Michael Batchelard, with additional reporting by Nick McKenzie. Production by Tom McKendrick and Tim Young. The consulting producers are Julie Pizzetti and Siobhan McHugh. Matt Absalom Wong manages web development for the series, and our production assistants are Jake Evans and Lucy Dean. Audience development support from Dewey Cook and Michael Schlechter. Our executive producer is Michael Batchelard. You can find extra features for this series at theage.com.au/Phoebe's Fall. And if you want to contact us anonymously, click on the link Do You Know Something? For access to the best investigations, news exclusives, commentary and more, subscribe to The Age or the Sydney Morning Herald at theage.com.au or smh.com.au. Just click subscribe.